So today we're going to be continuing the series of questions and answers. This is Majjhima Nikaya 44, the shorter series of questions and answers. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel's sanctuary. Then the lay follower Visakha went to the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. So the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina was an arahat, and Visakha was an anagami. Dhammadina was Visakha's former wife before she became a Bhikkhuni. And the story goes is that Visakha had gone to visit the Buddha, and he was gone all night listening to the Buddha's discourse. And as he was listening to it, he became an anagami. Next morning, he came back home, and he was very silent, very radiant, happy, relaxed. Didn't say a word. And his wife thought, what's going on? And then when they were ready to go to sleep together, he decided to sleep on the floor. He didn't want to sleep with her on the same bed. And she thought, this is strange. Maybe I did something to bother him or upset him. The next morning, she asked what happened. And he says that he's let go of all craving, all lust. Everything is gone after listening to the Buddha's discourse. So she said, oh, that's interesting. I'd like to check out the Buddha's discourse. So she went there and listened to the Buddha and was inspired to become a bhikkhuni. And Visakha was quite happy about this. And then she became an arahat. So now here is Visakha coming to Dhammadina, asking her questions. And after paying homage to her, he sat down at one side and asked her, Lady, identity is said. What is called identity by the Blessed One? Friend Visakha, these five aggregates affected by clinging are called identity by the Blessed One. That is the material form aggregate affected by craving and clinging. The feeling aggregate affected by craving and clinging. The perception aggregate affected by craving and clinging. The formations aggregate affected by craving and clinging. And the consciousness aggregate affected by craving and clinging. These five aggregates affected by craving and clinging are called identity by the Blessed One. Saying, good lady, the lay follower Visakha delighted and rejoiced in the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina's words. Then he asked her a further question. Lady, origin of identity is said. What is called the origin of identity by the Blessed One? Friend Visakha, it is craving, which brings renewal of being, is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for being, and craving for non-being. This is called the origin of identity. Lady, cessation of identity is said. What is called the cessation of identity by the Blessed One? Friend Visakha, it is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that same craving. This is called the cessation of identity by the Blessed One. Lady, the way leading to the cessation of identity is said. What is called the way leading to the cessation of identity by the Blessed One? Friend Visakha, it is just this Noble Eightfold Path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So we're going through the Four Noble Truths again, and we're applying it to understanding how identity arises. Identity is said to be when the mind takes personal any of the five aggregates, sees the body as self, sees feeling, experience as self, sees perception as self, sees intentions as self, or sees awareness as self. And that seeing it as self, that personalizing it, taking it personally, is that craving which leads to renewal of being, renewal of habitual tendencies, renewal of existence, of identity concretized into the sense of self. So that is the origin of identity, identification with the five aggregates. The cessation of identity is to let go of that identification, noticing it, using the Eightfold Path. How do you use the Eightfold Path? How do you apply the Eightfold Path? 6 hours. You guys are learning. Good. So using the 6 hours, applying right effort, you let go of the notion of self, personalizing things. Now here's an interesting question he asks. Lady, is that craving and clinging the same as the five aggregates affected by craving and clinging? Or is the craving and clinging something apart from the five aggregates affected by craving and clinging? In other words, we say these aggregates are affected by craving and clinging. These aggregates can be affected, have the potential of being influenced through craving and clinging. But is the craving and clinging the same or different from the five aggregates? This is what she says. Friend Visakha, the craving and clinging is neither the same as these five aggregates affected by craving and clinging, nor is craving and clinging something apart from the five aggregates affected by craving and clinging. Like I said, arhats never give you a straight answer. But she says, it is the desire and lust in regard to the five aggregates affected by craving and clinging, that is the craving and clinging there. The desire and lust in regard to the five aggregates. This form feels good to me, so I identify with it. This form is painful to me, so I want to push it away. The I comes up. This experience is pleasurable or unpleasant, and then there's an identity tied to it, this perception. So it's the identification with it. There is a sutta called Satta Sutta, S-A-T-T-A Sutta, Satta Sutta. Satta actually is the Pali for sattva, which means being in terms of a person, being in terms of, you know, a being, not like to be something. It's an actual being. So the question that's given to the Buddha is, what is being? What is the definition of being? Not to be, but what is the definition of a being? And the Buddha says the definition of a being is whenever there is attachment in reference to the five aggregates. Whenever the mind takes personally and identifies with form, feeling, perception, intention, and or awareness. So the question I pose based on that is, okay, that means there is no more being when you let go of identification. So the arahat, are they a being or are they a non-being? Could you say neither? Then what are they? Right. So the arahat realizes that there was no self to begin with. So the mind doesn't land on being or being a non-being. Lady, how does identity view come to be? So this is Sakaya Ditti. How does the sense of self view come to be? How does the belief in a personal self come to be? How does the intellectual attachment to the I, me, myself come to be? Here, friend Visakha, an untaught, ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma, regards material form as self, or self as possessed of material form, or material form as in self, or self as in material form. He regards feeling as self, or self as possessed of feeling, or feeling as in self, or self as in feeling. He regards perception as self, or self as possessed of perception, or self as in, or a perception as in self, or self as in perception. He regards formations as self, or self as possessed of formations, or formations as in self, or self as in formations. He regards awareness as self, or self as possessed of awareness, or awareness as in self, or self as in awareness. These are the 20 types of self-view that arise. The five aggregates multiplied by the four self-views. So the four self-views is, each of these five aggregates are considered as self, that these five aggregates are me. Or that there is a self that possesses these five aggregates. Or that the self resides in the five aggregates. Or that the five aggregates reside in some kind of overarching self. That is how identity view comes to be. Lady, how does identity view not come to be? Hear, friend Visakha, a well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in their dhamma, who has regard for true men and is skilled and disciplined in their dhamma, does not regard material form as self, or self as possessed of material form, or material form as in self, or self as in material form. He does not regard feeling as self, or self as possessed of feeling, or feeling as in self, or self as in feeling. He does not regard perception as self, or self as possessed of perception, or perception as in self, or self as in perception. He does not regard formations as self, or self as possessed of formations, or formations as in self, or self as in formations. He does not regard awareness as self, or self as possessed of awareness, or awareness as in self, or self as in awareness. That is how identity view does not come to be. In one who becomes a stream enterer, the first three fetters are destroyed. The first fetter is Sakaya Ditti, the belief in a personal self. The second is doubt in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And the third is clinging to rites and rituals. The first one, this is what we're talking about, Sakaya Ditti. When one becomes a stream enterer, they understand on a mental level, through some level of experience of seeing things as they are and detaching from the self concept, that indeed none of these five aggregates can be considered to be self. They see things as impersonal. That doesn't mean that they don't stop identifying, because there can be a point where they do identify. But in that process of identifying, they can recognize, oh, I'm identifying, and start letting go. That identification process, that deeper rooted identification process, is conceit, the mana, that is eradicated when you attain arahatship. Lady, what is the Noble Eightfold Path? Friend Visakha, it is just this Noble Eightfold Path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So we know what this is. Right view is, there's the mundane right view and the super mundane right view. The mundane right view understands action and consequence. That's the heart of that. The super mundane right view is completely understanding and experiencing the Four Noble Truths. Right intention is threefold. Renunciation, letting go of taking things personally, letting go of identifying with things. Non-ill will, facilitated through the cultivation of loving kindness. And non-cruelty, facilitated through the process of cultivating compassion. Right speech, refraining from harsh speech, false speech, slander, gossip, malicious speech, abusive speech. Think before you speak, right? T-H-I-N-K. Is it the right time to say what you want to say? Is it honest? What is the intention behind it? Is it intentionally wholesome or unwholesome? Is it necessary for you to say it? And can you say it with kindness? Right action, keeping the precepts, refraining from killing living beings, harming living beings, refraining from taking what is not given, refraining from sexual and sensual misconduct. And by extension, refraining from indulging in intoxicants, which can lead you to break the other precepts. And then we have right livelihood. Right livelihood is having livelihood that does not cause harm to oneself and to others. And then right effort. Preventing the unarisen, unwholesome states from arising. Abandoning the already arisen, unwholesome states. Generating unarisen, wholesome states. And then maintaining those arisen, wholesome states. In other words, six R's. And then right mindfulness. Seeing body as body, mind as mind, feeling as feeling, mind objects as mind objects. In relation to, is there craving or not? In essence, remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one object to the other. And then right concentration. Letting go of the hindrances, coming to a mind that is devoid of sensual pleasure, and then entering the different jhanas. Lady, is the Noble Eightfold Path conditioned or unconditioned? Friend Visakha, the Noble Eightfold Path is conditioned. You're using causes and conditions for the mind to let go at deeper and deeper levels until it ceases and touches the unconditioned. Lady, are the three aggregates included by the Noble Eightfold Path, or is the Noble Eightfold Path included by the three aggregates? Here, when they say three aggregates, they're not talking about three of the five aggregates. They're talking about the three categories: Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. The three aggregates are not included by the Noble Eightfold Path, friend Visakha. But the Noble Eightfold Path is included by the three aggregates: right speech, right action, right livelihood. These are included in the aggregate of virtue, Sila. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. These states are included in the aggregate of concentration, Samadhi. And we'll see more about how that happens. Right view and right intention. These states are included in the aggregate of wisdom, Panya. Lady, what is concentration? What is Samadhi? Right? What is the basis of samadhi? What is the equipment of samadhi? What is the development of samadhi? So the first question is, what is samadhi? Unification of mind, friend Visakha, is samadhi, ekagata, an attention that is non-dispersed, a mind that is not refracted, a mind that stays with its object of meditation, is samadhi, being collected. What is the basis of samadhi? The four foundations of mindfulness are the basis of samadhi. In other words, how do you come to samadhi? Recognizing when the mind is not in samadhi and bringing it back. Remembering to observe how your mind's attention moves from one object to the other. Right mindfulness is the basis of samadhi. So what is the equipment of samadhi? What are the tools used to gain samadhi? The four right efforts are the tools for samadhi, are the equipment of samadhi. So how do you get into samadhi? Recognizing your mind is distracted, releasing your attention from that distraction, relaxing the mind's tension and tightness, the craving in the mind and body, coming back to the smile, generating a wholesome state, and then returning back to an object of meditation. This is the six R's, the four right efforts. What is the development of samadhi? How do you continue to develop samadhi? The continual repetition, development, and cultivation of these states is a development of samadhi therein. Right effort, the six R's, to regain your mindfulness, which leads to collectedness, is the development of samadhi. When you let go, when your mind doesn't become collected anymore, becomes distracted, come back to right effort. Use the six R's, regain your mindfulness, deepen your awareness, come back to samadhi. When you get distracted again, do the same process. The cultivation, repetition of these states, the six R's, mindfulness, observation, and collectedness, is the development of samadhi. Every time you are not in jhana, to bring back your mind in jhana, six R, regain your mindfulness, and then develop collectedness. Lady, how many formations are there? How many types of samskaras are there? How many categories of sankharas are there? There are these three formations, friend Visakha: the bodily formation, the verbal formation, and the mental formation. But lady, what is the bodily formation? What is the verbal formation? What is the mental formation? In-breathing and out-breathing, inhalation and exhalation, friend, are the bodily formation. Applied thought and sustained thought are the verbal formation. Perception and feeling are the mental formation. So he asks an interesting question. He says, but lady, why are in-breathing and out-breathing the bodily formation? Why are applied thought and sustained thought, or thinking and examining thought, the verbal formation? Why are perception and feeling the mental formation? Friend Visakha, in-breathing and out-breathing are bodily. These are states bound up with the body. Any kind of states that are bound up with the body are included in the bodily formation. That is why these states are the bodily formation. In the case of the verbal formation, first one applies thought and then sustains thought, and subsequently one breaks out into speech. That is why applied thought and sustained thought are the verbal formation, thinking and examining thought. You see something, you have an experience of something, and then your mind sees it, contemplates it, thinks about it, and then you break out into speech of what it is you want to express based on that thought. These are constituted in verbal formation. Perception and feeling are mental. Even bodily perception and bodily feeling are mental. These are states bound up with the mind. That is why perception and feeling are the mental formation. Lady, how does the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness come to be? Friend Visakha, when a bhikkhu is attaining the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, it does not occur to him, I shall attain the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, or I am attaining the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, or I have attained the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. But rather, his mind has previously been developed in such a way that it leads him to that state. So in the process of predetermining how the mind attains cessation, there's no sense of the I attaining the cessation. There's just a predetermined time. Mind will cease and emerge after this many hours, or mind will emerge at so-and-so time, or whatever it might be. That's the prior intention, prior determination. But in the process of attaining, there's no thought that I am attaining. There's no thought that I have attained. Because when you actually get into cessation, your verbal formations cease. We'll see how that happens. As soon as you catch yourself going into cessation, that's where the trouble is. You're recognizing, oh, this is the pathway leading to cessation. What happens? Verbal formations come up. And then what happens? Your mind becomes agitated. So what do you do? 6R. Let go. Soften. Come back to the prior state before the mind heads towards cessation. And continue to develop that. It could be equanimity, which leads to disenchantment, which leads to dispassion, which leads to cessation. Your mind recognizing there's cessation and then getting agitated about it, excited about it, means that you haven't developed dispassion to the fullest extent. Dispassion doesn't care if it attains Nibbana or not. Nibbana happens when you least expect it, when you least anticipate it. Because anticipation and expectation are synonyms of craving. So recognizing you're about to get into cessation, or the fear that arises in taking that plunge, means there's not enough dispassion. Take a step backward. Come back to the dispassion. Continue to cultivate it. Let go of any expectations and don't do anything. And then when you least expect it, cessation. Lady, when a bhikkhu is attaining the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, which states cease first in him? The bodily formation, the verbal formation, or the mental formation? Friend Visakha, when the bhikkhu is attaining the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, first the verbal formation ceases, then the bodily formation ceases, then the mental formation ceases. Why is this? When you get to the fourth jhana, you start losing contact with the body, and the bodily formation starts to cease, and you become deep in your mind, where you start to experience infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and so on. But in the case of verbal formations, they cease in the second jhana. So first, the verbal formation ceases, right? Because you let go of the thinking and examining thought. The thoughts in the background have nothing to do with thinking and examining thought. The thoughts in the background are just feeling. But the prior determination through bringing up a feeling, using imagery, those kinds of things, those cease in the second jhana. So verbal formations cease in the second jhana. The bodily formations cease in the fourth jhana. And then the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness means all mental formations cease, because all feeling and perception ceases. All mental feeling and perception also ceases. Lady, how does emergence from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness come to be? Friend Visakha, when a bhikkhu is emerging from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, it does not occur to him, I shall emerge from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. Or, I am emerging from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. Or, I have emerged from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. But rather, his mind has been previously developed in such a way that it leads him to that state, prior determination of when mind will come out. But the thought that I am arising, that personalizing of it, does not come up. There's a knowing, mind has come out. And there is a big knowing that mind has come out because of what happens when mind comes out of cessation. Lady, when a bhikkhu is emerging from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, which states arise in him first? The bodily formation, the verbal formation, or the mental formation? Friend Visakha, when a bhikkhu is emerging from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, first the mental formation arises, then the bodily formation, then the verbal formation. Why is that? Because you experience mental feeling after making contact with Nibbana, which is what we're going to talk about now. And you experience joy and relief. That's the mental formation arising. And you feel it, the energy in your body, the bodily formation arises. And then you say, oh, wow, what was that? And that's the verbal formation. Lady, when a bhikkhu has emerged from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, how many kinds of contact touch him? Friend Visakha, when a bhikkhu has emerged from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, three kinds of contact touch him. Signless, the voidness contact, signless contact, and desireless contact. Voidness means it's empty of any kind of self. Signless means that it's not taking anything as an object. Desireless means that there is no direction in the mind going somewhere. Voidness comes from the realization of the emptiness of self, anatta. Signlessness comes from the realization of the impermanence of things, anicca. And desirelessness or undirected mind comes from the realization of dukkha, that any kind of direction somewhere will lead to dukkha. So the prior experience of this happens in infinite consciousness. You start to see the impermanent nature of consciousness, and it becomes tiresome, therefore you see dukkha, and then you realize there's no controller here, and you understand anatta. These three allow you then to experience Nibbana. So this contact that they're talking about, contact that is void or empty, contact that is signless, contact that is desireless, this is contact with the Nibbana element. When contact arises, what arises in dependence on contact? Feeling. Right? So when the contact with Nibbana element happens, what happens next? There is a feeling of joy and relief that is felt. There is a feeling of energy, a feeling of clarity. First time this happens, there's a lot of joy that comes up, a lot of energy. People can't sleep, and the joy lasts for a day, maybe a couple of days. And this is the feeling that's being experienced. So don't mistake the feeling of joy to be Nibbana. It is conditioned by the experience of Nibbana, by contact with Nibbana. But the contact with Nibbana itself is unconditioned. And so sometimes a question arises, how do these attainments happen? Through the prior development of right effort. The more you six-R, the more you let go of identification with processes, the more you let go of craving, the easier it is for your mind to stop taking personal the feeling of joy and relief that arise dependent upon contact with the Nibbana element. And so, when the mind makes contact with Nibbana, for that moment, mind is completely free. Free of the fetters, free of the taints, completely free. But what happens? When the feeling arises, there's an I, there's a me that grasps to that feeling and doesn't want that feeling to go away. So as you start to see this identification process, and as you start to let go of it deeper and deeper, then the next attainments happen. Until the experience of Nibbana is no big deal. When that happens, then arahatship. Mind doesn't, it's okay, cool, Nibbana, whatever. You know, but because the mind is always looking for it, there can still be the fetters, there can still be the taints. Lady, when a bhikkhu has emerged from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, to what does his mind incline? To what does it lean? To what does it tend? Friend Visakha, when a bhikkhu has emerged from the attainment of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, his mind inclines to seclusion, leads to seclusion, tends to seclusion. This is one translation of the word, that's the word seclusion. Of course, the mind after cessation is just like floating. Everything is just vivid. Feel like you're just, you know, on cloud nine, just floating around. Everything is fine. Not really talking to people. Don't care about people. Don't care about anything. Just want to be in there. That's one kind of seclusion. But there's something else which this word seclusion is translated from. That is viveka. Vivek. Discernment. How do you discern? What are you discerning? You are seeing the links of dependent origination and realizing for yourself how everything arises dependent upon impersonal causes and conditions. That's what your mind tends to. Seeing the links of dependent origination. Why? Because when your mind makes contact with Nibbana, it's unconditioned, that contact. But dependent upon that contact, there is feeling and perception. So there is the arising of the links of dependent origination based on that contact. If the mind clings to that feeling, ignorance continues again. Fettered formations arise again. Tainted consciousness arises again. And one sees the links of dependent origination in that way. If there's no clinging at all, this is why the sutta says, through not clinging, his mind was liberated. If there's no clinging, then it will just be seen as it is. No ignorance comes, no fettered formations arise, pure formations, dependent upon that contact arise, pure consciousness arises, and the rest of the series, until feeling. No craving, no clinging, no becoming, no birth of action, no whole mass of suffering arises. Lady, how many kinds of feeling are there? How many kinds of Vedana are there? Friend Visakha, there are three kinds of feeling. Pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. But lady, what is pleasant feeling? What is painful feeling? What is neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, whatever is felt bodily or mentally as pleasant and soothing is pleasant feeling. Whatever is felt bodily or mentally as painful and hurting is painful feeling. Whatever is felt bodily or mentally as neither soothing nor hurting is neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Lady, what is pleasant and what is painful in regard to pleasant feeling? That's an interesting question. What is pleasant and what is painful in regard to pleasant feeling? What is painful and what is pleasant in regard to painful feeling? What is pleasant and what is painful in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, pleasant feeling is pleasant when it persists, and painful when it changes. Painful feeling is painful when it persists, and pleasant when it changes. Neither painful nor pleasant feeling is pleasant when there is knowledge of it. You're paying attention to that feeling, even if it's neutral feeling, meaning there's complete mindfulness. And painful when there is no knowledge of it, lack of mindfulness. When there's a lack of awareness of it, there can arise the tendency of conceit, the tendency of craving, and so on and so forth, the tendency of identifying with that feeling. Lady, what underlying tendency underlies pleasant feeling? What underlying tendency underlies painful feeling? What underlying tendency underlies neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust underlies pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion underlies painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance underlies neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Makes sense? If it's a pleasant feeling, there will be this bending towards wanting it. If it's a painful feeling, there is this sense of not wanting it. And if it's a neutral feeling, there can arise lack of mindfulness to it, because it's neither painful nor pleasant. Now, this is an interesting question. He asks, lady, does the underlying tendency to lust underlie all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion underlie all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie all pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie all painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance does not underlie all neutral feeling. Why is that? When you have a pleasant feeling, only when you say this is my pleasant feeling and you want to hold on to it, does the underlying tendency to craving arise. Only when there's a painful feeling and you say, I don't like that painful feeling, does the underlying tendency to aversion arise. Only when there is a neutral feeling and you start identifying, or you don't even notice that feeling because there's lack of mindfulness, does the underlying tendency to ignorance arise. But if you are aware of pleasant feeling, if you're aware of painful feeling, if you're aware of neutral feeling, meaning there's complete mindfulness, complete attention. You don't take it permanent. You don't take it as personal. Then there won't be the underlying tendency to craving, to aversion, or to ignorance. Lady, what should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust. The underlying tendency to lust should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So you don't abandon the feeling. You can't siksar a feeling. You abandon the identification with that feeling. You abandon the lust for that pleasant feeling, the aversion for that painful feeling, and the ignorance of the neutral feeling. You abandon the lack of mindfulness, bring up more attention, understand it to be dependently arisen, let go of identifying with it because it is dependently arisen, therefore impermanent, therefore liable to cause suffering, therefore not to be seen as me, mine, or myself. The awareness, the observation, the mindfulness, the attention, that prevents the underlying tendencies from arising. And when they do arise, the regaining of mindfulness, of observation, of attention, lets go of those underlying tendencies. Now here's the other question. Lady, does the underlying tendency to lust have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance have to be abandoned in regard to all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, the underlying tendency to lust does not have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion does not have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance does not have to be abandoned in regard to all neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Why? If you're already aware, then there won't be underlying tendencies in regards to those feelings. So you don't have to abandon them all the time. They are only abandoned insofar as when they arise due to lack of attention, lack of mindfulness, lack of awareness, lack of observation. Now here's a deeper explanation of that. Here, friend Visakha, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. With that, he abandons lust, and the underlying tendency to lust does not underlie that. Here, a bhikkhu considers thus, when shall I enter upon and abide in that base that the noble ones now enter upon and abide in one who thus generates a longing for the supreme liberation. A longing here is chanda, wholesome inclination. Grief arises with that longing as condition. Grief in the sense of samvega, the desire for liberation. With that, he abandons aversion, and the underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie that. Here, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Fourth jhana. With that, he abandons ignorance, and the underlying tendency to ignorance does not underlie that. So the first jhana allows you to let go of lust and the underlying tendency to lust. The chanda towards liberation allows you to let go of identifying with painful feeling and the underlying tendency to aversion. And then the fourth jhana, there's neutrality there, complete awareness there, strong mindfulness. So no underlying tendency to ignorance can arise. Technically speaking, none of the underlying tendencies would be present if you are in jhana in the right way. That is to say, you have metacognition. You understand that jhana to be impermanent and conditioned, therefore you don't take it personally. So there won't be any arising of aversion, craving, ignorance, doubt, views, conceit, or the desire for being. So I'll read that again. Here, a bhikkhu considers thus, when shall I enter upon and abide in that base that the noble ones now enter upon and abide in one who thus generates a longing for the supreme liberation, grief arises with that longing as condition. With that, he abandons aversion, and the underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie that. So, when there is the chanda for liberation, the mind does not take that painful feeling, or even the pleasant feeling, as personally. It lets go of the attachment to anything. All it's looking for is nibbana. All its mind is inclined to is nibbana. Which means it's not going to try to explore how did this painful feeling arise. It's not going to try to explore and see what is happening in regards to this painful feeling. It will only seek any identification process that's going there and then letting go of that. Now we get into what's known as the counterparts. The counterpart comes from the word patipada. There's two connotations for patipada. One is what leads to that next step, and what is the opposite of that. So now I'll explain why this is the case. So he asks, lady, what is the counterpart of pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, painful feeling is the counterpart of pleasant feeling. Makes sense, right? Painful feeling is the opposite of pleasant feeling. What is the counterpart of painful feeling? Pleasant feeling. Pleasant feeling is the opposite of painful feeling. Painful feeling is the opposite of pleasant feeling. So far, so good. What is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Ignorance is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling. It's not saying ignorance is the opposite of neither painful or pleasant feeling. It's saying ignorance, you get to ignorance through neither painful nor pleasant feeling when there's lack of mindfulness of it. So this case, it's not the opposite, but it's leading to that. Now he asks, what is the counterpart of ignorance? Wisdom, true knowledge, is the counterpart of ignorance. Now he's asking, what is the opposite of ignorance in this case? So, true knowledge, wisdom. What is the counterpart of true knowledge? But he's not asking this time, what is the opposite? What is the counterpart? What does true knowledge lead to? Liberation. Nibbana. Liberation. Deliverance of mind. Is the counterpart of true knowledge. What? Well, okay. So actually it's deliverance of mind, which is cessation. What is the counterpart of deliverance? Not what is the opposite of deliverance. What does deliverance lead to? Now it's Nibbana. Nibbana is the counterpart of deliverance. Lady, what is the counterpart of Nibbana? Friend Visakha, you have pushed this line of questioning too far. You are not able to grasp the limit to questions, for the holy life, friend Visakha, is grounded upon Nibbana, culminates in Nibbana, ends in Nibbana. If you wish, friend Visakha, go to the Blessed One and ask him about the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains it to you, so you should remember it. Then the lay follower Visakha, having delighted and rejoiced in the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina's words, rose from his seat and after paying homage to her, keeping her on his right, he went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One his entire conversation with the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. When he finished speaking, the Blessed One told him, "The Bhikkhuni Dhammadina is wise, Visakha. The Bhikkhuni Dhammadina has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina has explained it. Such is its meaning, and so you should remember it." That is what the Blessed One said. The lay follower Visakha was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. But there's another sutta called Kamabhu Sutta, and it's very similar to the other sutta that we just read. But in that sutta, the question is, how do you get to this experience? Like, what is it facilitated by? And he says serenity and insight yoked together. In other words, you need both samatha and vipassana to get to cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. That's all I wanted to explain to you.